Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Its swift and devastating effects on the human body are more than enough to make Ebola terrifying. But there is also something eerie about the way it seems to lose its appetite for victims, disappearing sometimes for years without a human case, only to come roaring back seemingly out of nowhere. So where does Ebola hide in the natural world? If humans are not its usual vectors, what creature or substance does harbor the virus between outbreaks? Journalist David Quammen traveled with viral ecologists working to track Ebola to its hiding place in nature, and he shares what he learns in his new article, Stalking a Killer. The piece will appear in the July issue of National Geographic magazine. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Who was the first person to become sick with Ebola in the devastating outbreak of the past year and a half?
Yeah, we know that the term is index case. The first known human case was a little boy, about a two-year-old boy named Emile Uamuno in a little village in southeastern Guinea. The village is called Meliandu. All of this was determined retrospectively. At the time, nobody knew that he had Ebola, but he died with dramatic symptoms, and then his sister died, and his mother died, and his grandmother. That was all back in December of 2013, in this little village. It wasn't until March, with more cases in that village and in surrounding villages, that authorities figured out, wait a minute, this is not some routine, fever. This is Ebola. This is the one that we most dread.
So the question is, if Emile did not catch Ebola from another person, how did he get sick?
That is exactly the question. It's the question, one of the questions I explore in the piece in Geographic. The question is, what did he do? What did he touch? Where was he? What did he eat? How did he get infected? The first case in any outbreak of Ebola virus disease or any of these emerging viral diseases, the first case when a human suddenly becomes sick, that event is known as a spillover. The virus spills over from its reservoir host, whatever creature it lives in the wild, endemically, inconspicuously, without causing symptoms over time. When it spills over from that creature into the first human case, then we have an outbreak. And in some instances, it's possible to know what happened. A person got Ebola from a dead chimpanzee, but of course that leaves the question of how the chimpanzee got Ebola, because chimpanzees and gorillas are susceptible to it too. With the case of Emile, we don't know. We don't know what he did. We don't know how he got infected. And that brings science back to the question of the reservoir host.
Ebola was only identified as a discrete disease in 1976, and there have not been that many outbreaks since then, although they always seem to be dreadful. Is there any discernible pattern, David, as to when and where cases emerge?
There are a few patterns. As you say, 1976 was the first known outbreak in Zaire, of what we now call Ebola virus disease. There was an outbreak at the same time in southern Sudan of something that was called Ebola then, but now it's called Sudan virus. It's a close relative of Ebola. And there have been about 20 outbreaks of Ebola virus disease over those 39 years since the first. Sometimes it disappears for years at a time. In one case, there was even a stretch from 1977 to 1994, so what's that, 17 years, a stretch when there was no outbreak, detected outbreak of Ebola virus disease. So it disappears for years at a time. When it does reappear, there are some patterns. Usually it's connected to the forest. It tends to spill over in remote Central African villages and now most recently in West African villages. Sometimes it spreads to the cities, but it seems to begin in the forest. Ebola virus is different from another close relative, Marburg virus, in that Marburg virus seems to be associated with caves and mine shafts. Ebola virus does not seem to be associated with caves and mine shafts, but with trees and jungle. So that's one of the patterns that scientists have looked at in trying to trace back to figure out where the virus lives, what the reservoir host is.
And viruses, in fact, need a living host to hang on for any length of time. Is that right? It couldn't just be something that's in the soil or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. Viruses can only replicate in living cells. Viruses are not cellular creatures themselves. They're not even quite alive, depending on how you define life. They can only replicate using the cell machinery of a living cell. That means they've got to abide in another creature, a plant, an animal, a fungus, some other kind of critter, even a bacteria. But the viruses that affect humans most likely abide in other animals. We know that there are viruses that infect humans, quite a number of them that spill over from bats. Bats are the reservoir host. In some cases, it's rodents. But it has to be a creature, a living creature of some sort, for the virus to replicate and abide over the long stretches of time.
Why is it so hard to track the virus to a reservoir host in the wild, which is really at the heart of this piece?
Yes, right. It's hard for a couple of reasons. One is that when there is an outbreak of Ebola virus disease, then it's horrific. People are sick. People are dying. Health workers are trying to contain the spread. They're trying to care for people. And it's a bad situation for other scientists to come in dressed in their moon suits and start collecting bats and rodents and other creatures and dissecting them and looking for the virus. It's a bad time to do science because there's a public health crisis because medical help is needed. So that's one of the problems. And then when an outbreak is over, as we've been saying, the virus disappears back into its reservoir host. And so it's harder for scientists to know exactly where to look. Also, once an outbreak is over, at least this was true in the past, the high level of interest dissipates. There is not as much attention, not as much press attention, and not as much funding support after the outbreak. Now, this outbreak that in West Africa has been so huge and has gotten so much attention and raised so much concern that presumably there will continue to be support for the science that's necessary after this fire is put out in order to discover what is the reservoir host.
Reading about this sort of thing, you know, we're here in North Texas, it always makes me think of a tornado, how it seems to come from nowhere and it touches down on the ground and wreaks havoc. And then as mysteriously as it came, almost, it's gone.
That's true. That's true. It's true not just of Ebola and tornadoes, but a number of these other emerging viral diseases. The scientists call them zoonoses because they spill over from animal hosts into humans. And some of them seemingly come out of nowhere and cause real misery, death, chaos, destruction in human populations. We're hearing about MERS, M-E-R-S, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus in Korea now, which is raising a lot of concern because it's similar to the SARS virus, and that was such a dangerous virus coming out of China in 2003. They appear seemingly out of nowhere. They make people sick, they kill people, and then they disappear again.
In April of last year, as the virus was picking up steam in Western Africa, a German disease ecologist traveled to Southern Guinea. What did he find when he visited Emile's home village?
Right. This is a scientist named Fabian Leendertz, based in Berlin. And he's worked in West Africa for decades studying zoonotic diseases, especially viral diseases that spill out of animals and non-human animals and get into humans. He had been working in Ivory Coast, which is adjacent to Guinea and Liberia. And so when it was learned that this was Ebola and that it had begun in this area of southeastern Guinea, Fabian Leendertz collected an international team and converged on that area of southeastern Guinea to try and learn something about the beginning of this outbreak, about the reservoir host. He did a couple of kinds of research, he and his team. There were forest reserves, protected areas there. They hiked, they did transects, walking surveys through those forest reserves to see if there was any pattern of dead animals, dead chimpanzees, dead forest antelope, dead monkeys, that might suggest effects of Ebola upon them, and the possibility that a human had found a carcass of an animal dead of Ebola, picked it up, and eaten it. They found no evidence of a die-off among the non-human animals. And then they went to the outbreak village, the original index village itself, Meliandu, and they started talking to people there and hearing stories. One in particular that caused concern and raised their interest, and that was about a hollow tree filled with a certain type of small insect-eating bat. This tree had been filled with these bats, and the children of the village, possibly including Emil, used to play in this hollow tree and have close contact with these bats. Sometimes they would even catch these bats, kill them, roast them on sticks over fires to eat, like you would roast marshmallows. And so Fabian and his team wondered whether there was a possibility that that kind of a bat, that species of bat, the Angolan free-tailed bat, had perhaps been carrying the virus and exposed Emil. So they started collecting samples. First, they collected soil samples and confirmed with DNA sequencing that it was the Angolan free-tailed bat living in that tree. The tree had been burnt by villagers in the meantime, and the bats were gone, so they had to collect ashes and dirt to identify the bat. And then in November of last year, they went back to West Africa to collect large numbers of that species of bat, the Angolan free-tailed bat, to take blood samples and tissue samples and look for signs of Ebola. And that's when I went along with them and the photographer that I work with, Pete Muller. We accompanied Fabian and his team to Ivory Coast during the outbreak in the adjacent countries as he looked for evidence of Ebola in this particular species. This species had not been a suspect or not been a major suspect previously, and suddenly it had been added to the list of suspects, so he wanted to see if he could confirm that.
Why did the villagers burn the tree?
Nobody really knows. Fabian didn't seem to be able to find out for sure, but there was some suggestion that they had done it to harvest honey from the tree.
So they weren't thinking that there was Ebola related to the bats and had done it themselves?
It's reasonable to wonder that, but there's really no satisfactory answer to that. People were a little bit vague about that when they were interviewing him in the village of Meliandu, and people apparently sort of turned their palms up and said, honey gathering, we can't really tell you.
If it were the case, I'm just speaking in general here, would it be a bad idea to sort of displace this population of bats that might harbor an infection and send them elsewhere?
Well, these are very common bats in West Africa, as I saw during our time in Ivory Coast. These are bats that don't roost in caves, don't roost only in trees, but also roost in the thatched roofs of people's houses. And these little mud wattle buildings in the villages, built very simply with thatched roofs, and in some cases slightly more modern. They have corrugated metal roofs. The bats fly in through the cracks between the walls and the roof, and they roost there during the day. And then they come out through the holes at night to fly around and eat insects. One of the spooky things about that is that if this bat is the reservoir, it's living in very close proximity to a lot of people. And the question then is, why haven't there been more spillovers?
We're speaking with journalist David Quammen. His article, Stalking a Killer, about the Ebola virus will appear in the July issue of National Geographic. We'll be back in 2 minutes. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science journalist David Quammen. His article, Stalking a Killer, about tracking the Ebola virus to its source in the wild, will appear in the July issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. All right, for a little context here, David, let's go back and talk about the Marburg virus, which you mentioned earlier, also a very nasty disease, speculatively linked to animal hosts. Tell us about the first human cases and how they arose.
Right. Marburg. Marburg has that name because of the city of Marburg in Germany. 1967, a shipment of monkeys intended for medical research were sent up to Marburg and also to Frankfurt and a couple of towns, one town in Yugoslavia. And these monkeys apparently were carrying, well, they clearly were carrying a virus. Some laboratory workers got sick in Marburg, Frankfurt, Belgrade. Some of their loved ones, family members became sick. A handful of people died. And a new virus was found in them. It was given the name Marburg after that city. It was what is now called a filovirus, long thread-like virus, like a piece of vermicelli. And it was traced to those monkeys, which had come from Uganda, as I said. That was the first of the filoviruses. And then in 1976, when Ebola emerged and was looked at under electron microscope, scientists saw that, well, this is another of those vermicelli-like things. It's another filovirus. So they classified it in the same family as Marburg virus. Marburg virus is as lethal as Ebola virus. It's gotten a little bit less attention, maybe a lot less attention as of the last year and a half. But it functions in similar ways. It hasn't caused as many outbreaks over the last 40 years as Ebola has, but it has spilled over on certain occasions. And it has been traced to its reservoir host. We now know with Marburg virus that the reservoir host is a large species of bat, the Egyptian fruit bat that lives in caves in East and Central Africa. So that fact that Marburg's reservoir host has been identified is one of the things that represents a clue in the search for Ebola's reservoir host, and it's one of the things that has caused scientists to look particularly carefully at bats.
How were bats identified in the Marburg case? You mentioned earlier that outbreaks were often associated, outbreaks other than the ones that happened in Germany, were often associated with like mines and caves. And then a scientist started considering that link and then trying to sort of infect different organisms to prove his hypothesis.
That's right. A fellow named Robert Swanepoel, a virologist in South Africa, responded to some of the outbreaks. He went to an outbreak of Ebola in 1996, and he went to another outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, as Zaire was eventually known, in 1998 and 2000. And the Marburg outbreak in 1998-2000 surrounded a mining town called Durba, where there were both underground mines for minerals and there were what we call open pit mines. And he noticed that among the cases of Marburg virus, most of them were associated with workers who had been in the underground mines. And the people who had been working in the open pit mines had been much less likely to get sick. That's one of the things that started him thinking about mine and cave roosting bats as a possible reservoir host. Chris, I don't describe this in the National Geographic article, but in my book on Ebola, which is published under that title, Ebola, the Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus, last fall, I talk about the next stage in identifying the reservoir host of Ebola, work done by some heroic researchers from the CDC, the U.S. CDC, Brian Amon, Jonathan Towner, and their colleagues, who went to mines in Uganda, climbed down into mines that were associated with recent Marburg outbreaks, collected a lot of these Egyptian fruit bats, sampled them, took the specimens back to the CDC in Atlanta, and succeeded in growing live Marburg virus. And that's the gold standard of proof for a reservoir host. That established the fact that these bats are Marburg's reservoir, but that standard has never been met with Ebola.
Because it's one thing to prove in a lab that you can infect an animal. It's another thing to find in the wild that an animal has incubated the virus.
That's right. And there are different levels of evidence. For instance, with Ebola, there are three kinds of fruit bat that have been found to contain antibodies against Ebola virus and found to contain viral fragments of Ebola RNA that could be amplified using what they call PCR technology, ways of amplifying DNA and RNA. So those are like finding footprints of Ebola in those three kinds of bats. As I say in the National Geographic piece there, to find antibodies against Ebola or fragments of Ebola RNA is like finding the footprints of a Yeti in the snow. But to isolate live virus is like finding the foot of a live Yeti in a leg-hold trap, and that hasn't yet been done with Ebola.
David Quammen is my guest. We're talking about his article in the July issue of National Geographic called Stalking a Killer. Speaking of Ebola, by the way, on Monday we spoke with Louise Tro, the former fiancée of Thomas Eric Duncan, the first man to die of the Ebola virus on U.S. soil. If you missed that show, you can check out the podcast at kera.org/think. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Laura on the line in Dallas. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just wondering if, being from Dallas, I was actually just a couple blocks from where Eric Duncan lived, and so I wonder now if we are at a higher risk here of maybe the virus having infected a reservoir host here that we don't know about and that might spill over in the future down the line in Dallas or surrounding areas.
Thanks for your call. What can you tell us, David?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, but Laura, I would say no. Of all the things that you should worry about, you probably should worry about being hit by a bus or by a meteorite more than you should worry about that. The possibility, we even know that, for instance, Louise Tro and her children, I believe, who shared that apartment with Thomas Eric Duncan, they did not contract Ebola. It's not that easy to transmit. The fact that the two nurses in Dallas, who had helped take care of Duncan, became infected, of course, was the thing that scared the bejesus out of everybody. That was not supposed to happen. That still, as far as I know, has not been very clearly explained. But notwithstanding that fact, we know that it's not that transmissible. And in terms of it being transmitted to a new host, well, I guess all we can say is that has never been known to happen for a zoonotic virus to pass from its natural reservoir host into humans and then escape from humans back into a new reservoir host. I wouldn't say it's impossible. I'd say it's vanishingly unlikely. There is, however, some concern that with the ongoing outbreak in West Africa, and it is still ongoing in Guinea and Sierra Leone, the fact that there have been so many cases and it's been circulating in humans so long, people start to wonder, well, is there a chance that it could get into a new reservoir host? For instance, maybe dogs or rats. This is kind of gruesome, but there were cases where dogs and rats were eating the flesh of dead bodies. Would that be a possible way for the virus to get into one of those mammals and set up housekeeping, become endemic in those? No evidence of that so far, but the German scientist Fabian Lienderts that we've discussed is working to establish a research project to look for that possibility.
Okay, so Lienderts and his colleagues were trapping bats in order to test their blood and look for antibodies, that sort of thing. I've got some bats in my neighborhood in the evenings. I guess they're Mexican free-tail bats, probably. I can't imagine mm-hmm. trying to catch one. How do you go about that?
Well, he worked out a fairly ingenious trapping system because he wanted not to just sample bats. He wanted to get, wherever possible, entire subpopulations of bats. In other words, if there were 150 bats living under the rafters of the thatched roof of one house in a village, he wanted to try and get all 150 of them, or as many as possible. And so we went to this town in central Ivory Coast. We went to the market. We bought these long wooden, not exactly 2x4s, but long wooden beams. We bought clear plastic. He had brought a staple gun. And then they constructed these large plastic funnels that could be set up at the holes under the roof from which the bats emerged. We would go out during one day, and at twilight, we'd see where the bats emerged. And then he'd come back the next afternoon and set up these funnels at those holes of emergence. And then at the bottom of the funnel, he had a very simple plastic tub. So the bats would fly out at dusk. They would hit these plastic funnels, which would sort of knock them out of their flight path. They would slide down and go plop, 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 plop into these plastic buckets. And then Leendertz and his students and associates would reach in there carefully with gloves, pull the bats out, and start to process them.
I mean, reach in carefully with gloves, I'm sure that was the case. I mean, to think that you might be carrying around a tub of Ebola vectors has to be a sobering thing.
It is. It's a very peculiar situation because these people, they do this sort of thing all the time where they work looking for these very dangerous viruses. They're the disease detectives of these emerging diseases. They're viral ecologists. So they go out sampling animals, hoping to find deadly viruses. Leendertz is trained as a veterinarian. Generally, they have training as veterinarians, as well as virologists, and in some cases ecologists. So they know how to handle animals carefully, gently, whenever possible, without hurting the animals, and except when they kill them to dissect them, which is only a fraction of the animals they handle, and without getting hurt themselves. But you have to be very careful. You're working with needles and sharp probes and scalpels. You're hoping that these animals contain Ebola virus. The animals have teeth and claws. It's a dicey situation, and it's pretty inspiring to watch these professionals go at it. I make a point of standing 4 feet behind them when this is all happening.
I would be 40 feet, so kudos to you. What are you wearing, like a hat and gloves and long sleeves yourself, or what do you do?
Well, in some cases, I've been asked to wear a mask and gloves. In other cases, standing 4 feet, 5 feet behind them is enough. You don't want to be sprayed with fluid, but Ebola does not pass through the air in aerosol form, and so I just stay 4 or 5 feet back, stay the hell out of the way, and watch as carefully as I can these tiny, very sobering, very precise, dangerous procedures that the scientists are doing.
So you and I have talked before on the show about zoonotic mm-hmm. Pathogens, but I want to go over this again. Most people are aware that there are plenty of things that infect one species but not another, but there are also some that sort of cross over so that our dogs can catch a cold from us and people can get toxoplasmosis if they live with a cat, that sort of thing. What do we know about why these bats might carry viruses like Marburg or Ebola and not develop symptoms, at least not symptoms serious enough to cause any threat to their lives?
Yeah. Well, that's the nature of a reservoir host. As you say, we've talked about these zoonotic diseases. There's a whole list of them. It includes all the influenzas. It includes hantavirus. It includes Ebola, something called Nipah from Southeast Asia, MERS, SARS, etc. They have their reservoir hosts in which they live for the long term, inconspicuously, without causing really noticeable symptoms. And presumably that relationship represents a long period of mutual tolerance or developing mutual tolerance over evolutionary time. So if the virus has been in a particular kind of bat for a million years, that bat has presumably developed a tolerance for it. Its immune system essentially ignores the presence of the virus. And the virus in a reservoir host, it survives, it replicates, but it doesn't replicate abundantly. It doesn't replicate crazily. There's been sort of a peace, or at least a ceasefire reached between the virus and the reservoir host, so that the virus replicates at low levels. And again, that's one of the things that makes it difficult to identify the reservoir host, the fact that the virus is there, but it's not abundantly there. It's there lurking at relatively low levels, and not in every animal of the reservoir host population, but maybe only in a fraction of them, maybe only in 5%. If it's bats, maybe only in 5 bats out of 100. Again, that makes it hard to identify the reservoir host.
And so it may be that those bats don't give the virus to each other, but get it by eating or being bitten by an insect.
Well, then we come, that's the mysterious and spooky climax of my article and of the conversations I had while researching that article. One hypothesis as to why 39 years have passed and we still haven't identified the reservoir host of Ebola, one hypothesis put to me by a wonderful, bright young virologist that I know, Jens Kuhn at the National Institutes of Health, is that, as he called it, maybe it's a strange host or a strange host situation. Maybe it's a two-host situation. That might explain why these Ebola outbreak events are relatively infrequent, why years go by without one happening. If it were simply a matter of the virus living in a bat, then you'd think it would spill over into humans whenever there was a contact. But if the virus lives in another creature, only occasionally infecting a bat, for instance, a tick that bites a bat, and then the bat infects humans, that sort of double whammy relationship might explain why these spillovers happen, but they happen very infrequently.
David Quammen is with us. We're talking about his July article for National Geographic. It's called Stalking a Killer. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science journalist David Quammen, who writes for the July issue of National Geographic magazine about the hunt for a reservoir species, something that could be carrying the Ebola virus between human outbreaks. The piece will be called Stalking a Killer. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from someone who wants to know about the extent to which the Ebola virus might remain in the bodies of people who survive.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. We learn that it does. We learned recently that not only does it survive in potentially in the sperm of males who have recovered from Ebola virus disease, but there was a case where it was detected months after a patient had been released from treatment, where Ebola virus was living in the man's eyeball. I don't remember that fellow's name, but his iris changed color, and he thought, that's strange. I don't like that. Went back to the doctors, and they sampled his eye, and they found, oh, my God, this guy's got live Ebola virus still living in his eyeball. So there are lots of things about this disease that we still don't understand, and that certainly is high on the list.
We know that there are other viruses where there can be long-term damage after the like crisis moment of illness has passed, right? Because West Nile virus can later on mm-hmm. cause damage to internal organs. So that aspect of it may not be so unusual. Even the chickenpox and shingles thing is something we know is a factor.
Yeah, the chickenpox shingles thing is a very different kind of virus. It's a virus, it's a herpes virus that goes latent in the body and lives in the nerves over decades of time. Very different from Ebola virus, which is generally a very impatient virus, a very dramatic virus, and belongs to a different group, completely different group of viruses. But still, yeah, there's a lot that we still don't understand. I mean, before this outbreak in West Africa, when I was writing about this subject, I was making the point that the experts had said to me, look, one of the things that we have never had was an Ebola patient who was being treated but also studied in a very controlled, high-tech research hospital. Most of these people who have been sickening and dying in provincial hospitals in the African bush, in their villages or wherever, and it hasn't been possible to do science as well as treatment. So when early on in the West African outbreak, when those two Americans were brought back to the Emory Hospital in Atlanta, I think it was Kent Brantwell and I can't remember the woman's name. There was controversy over, should they be brought into the country if they're sick with Ebola? Of course, the facilities at Emory were built for just that sort of situation, and so they were well equipped to take care of those people. But the other point about that was that that was an opportunity to learn more about how Ebola virus affects the human body, to learn things that had not been learned in the previous 40 years.
Is there any evidence that there might be multiple strains of Ebola, some of which would confer immunity but wouldn't necessarily cause the really deadly range of symptoms caused by the Ebola virus that we classify as such and that has done such damage in West Africa?
Well, first of all, there are actually five kinds of what are called the Ebola viruses. Ebola that we've been talking about today is one of those five, and it's the only one that, according to the conventions of scientific naming, now can legitimately be called Ebola virus. I mentioned another one, the one from southern Sudan, which is now called Sudan virus, used to be called Ebola virus Sudan. Now, those matters of terminology are best left to the experts, but the basic point is that there are five different major kinds of the Ebola virus group. One of them is from Ivory Coast, where Fabian Leendertz has done his work. One of them is this major Ebola virus that had been known mostly in Central Africa until this West African outbreak. There's another one called Bundibugyo that's known from Uganda. Reston virus that's known only from an outbreak in Reston, Virginia, and the Philippines. And that's another whole confusing subject, what this virus is doing in the Philippines. And is that five? I think so. There are a number of different strains. You could argue there are many different strains, different variants within those five. And it's possible, yes, that that some of them are less lethal, less virulent than others. For instance, here's another mysterious fact for which we don't yet have an explanation. There have been surveys of people in Cameroon, another country in Western Central Africa, that has never had an Ebola outbreak, but blood surveys have shown that a large portion of the people, I think it's something maybe like 20% of the people sampled in Cameroon showed antibodies to Ebola. Suggesting that they had been exposed to Ebola sometime in the past, some event that really didn't hit the medical radar screens. So again, we're at very early stages of understanding this disease, and it's possible that there are more surprises coming.
What evidence is there that we could produce something like a vaccine against Ebola?
Well, people are working on vaccines. There are vaccines being tested in West Africa right now. There's a woman named Nancy Sullivan at the NIH, I believe Nancy's at the NIH, who has been working on leading a group working on an Ebola vaccine for 10 years. That vaccine has been in clinical trials in West Africa. There's another major effort to develop a vaccine. There hasn't been a whole lot of focus on that or a lot of funding for it over the years because Ebola had not affected very many people. And the people that it had affected were mostly poor Africans. And therefore, not to be cynical about the international drug companies, but they're in business. And when they invest in research and development, they do it generally if they see a major potential for profit at the end. And that major potential for profit did not exist with Ebola. There was concern for national security, bioterrorism. There was some support from the Department of Homeland Security for efforts on an Ebola vaccine because of that sort of biostrategic significance. And now, of course, there's a lot more attention and more support for the possibility of vaccines since last year, having shown us that this disease is capable of going big.
This is kind of an unrelated question, but it's one I've wondered about for a while. Are there, like, women born before 1976 walking around who were named Ebola?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Chris. It's possible, but, I mean, the name comes from a river in Zaire. I don't know what the ethnic or etymological source is for that name of the river.
It's just funny when something becomes associated with something, you know, a river is typically thought to be a beautiful thing. And now, we hear this word and it really strikes fear into our hearts.
What was just a routine, simple local place name until 1976, after 1976 became this scary word. And of course, that is something that scientists now take into account when a new virus appears and they decide what to name it. For instance, Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome virus. It's no accident that that virus is not named, you know, Mecca virus or Riyadh virus. That's bad politics and economics to name a scary new virus after a place that you're hoping people will visit.
All right, David, let's assume that we will get to a place where we can definitively trace the source of the Ebola virus to its reservoir in the wild. We know exactly where it comes from. What could we do with that information that might help prevent future outbreaks?
Right. That's a ticklish but important question. What we could do with it is try and prevent future outbreaks by keeping people away from that reservoir host, by eliminating or reducing the forms of contact between that reservoir host creature and humans. For instance, if it turns out to be a species of bat, then we need to educate people not to hunt bats for food, not to buy bats in the market for food, not to cut down trees that are filled with roosting bats, and to keep their distance from that particular kind of bat. What we don't want to do is have people saying, oh, well, so we know it's the Egyptian fruit bat from Marburg. Look, let's eradicate the Egyptian fruit bat. No, that's the wrong way to proceed, because the Egyptian fruit bat, besides harboring Marburg virus, functions as part of a diverse ecosystem and has a lot of value and has important roles to perform. So if we start eliminating creatures, trying to exterminate these viruses by exterminating their reservoir hosts, we'll cause more harm than good.
Is there speculation that, and I don't know about the amount of increased development taking place in the countries that were affected by Ebola in this outbreak of disease, but is there speculation that more human development and roads in places that roads didn't exist before might have played a role, particularly in the spread of this illness into urban areas?
Well, yes, absolutely. Although I don't think I don't know of any measurements on that. There are really two things, I think, two parts to your question. One is that does increasing development increase the possibility of a spillover? And secondly, given a spillover, one human case, does this sort of development increase the capacity for the thing to spread? The answer to the second question is definitely yes. The answer to the first question is very possibly, but we really don't know because we don't yet know what the reservoir host is. But in the case of this West African outbreak, which became an epidemic, the fact that, first of all, once again, we saw the outbreak begin in a remote village surrounded not entirely by good forest, but by second growth and scrub forest and greenery and not in a highly developed area. So a fair amount of biological diversity, animals, other creatures sharing the landscape with humans. The virus gets into the little boy Emil and it gets into others in the village. And then it spreads by foot trail, by buses, probably by bicycle, by private car or bush taxi. It spreads to the provincial towns and to the capital cities before long. Why? Well, for one reason, the capital cities of those West African countries are not that far away from the bush. The capitals are Conakry, Monrovia of Liberia, and Freetown, Sierra Leone, and they're just not that far away from the more easterly bush areas where the outbreak began. So it got into those capital cities, got into very poor neighborhoods where people were living at high density with inadequate health care and inadequate sanitation, and it spread badly. And that's partly because of increasing human population, increasing travel, increasing development, cutting down trees, building roads, etc.
One other interesting element of this is that scientists who can be working very sincerely and really think that they're onto something, you never quite know what the important information is. And you cite in the article the case of an Australian student who died of Marburg in 1975. Initially, researchers were really focused on the fact that he had like a nasty spider bite somewhere on his body, and they thought, well, surely this must be what touched off the illness.
Yeah, that's really an interesting part of this. I call him the hitchhiker. Hmm. Australian student traveling across Rhodesia with his girlfriend, 1975, gets sick, dies in a hospital in South Africa, and they find in his body the Marburg virus, this relatively new virus that had only been recognized 8 years earlier in Marburg, Germany. So he's the first known African death from Marburg virus. So the epidemiologists then say, well, how did this guy get sick? What did he do? What did he and his girlfriend do? Well, they were hitchhiking. They slept in some pastures. They went to a wildlife reserve and fed some animals, fed some monkeys. They bought some wild meat, eland meat at the side of the road. All of these things might have been risk factors. And, oh, this guy had some sort of a bite on his back, either from maybe it was a sting from an insect or a bite from a spider, and it was a little bit inflamed. And they focused on that. But that led nowhere. And then it was realized that they had also visited some caves where there were bats. That clue helped Bob Swanepoel focus, because he knew about this case, helped this South African virologist Bob Swanepoel focus on bats as suspects. And as I've described, bats eventually were confirmed, the Egyptian fruit bat, as a reservoir host. But now the fact that there was a bug bite there comes back to being maybe an important clue as we think about Jens Kuhn's two-host, strange host hypothesis about the reservoir of Ebola.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. David Quammen's new article, Stalking a Killer, will appear in the July issue of National Geographic. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. I always enjoy talking with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.